Ah d'accord, ok, très bien, très bien. Tu. Ok, excellent. Ok. On va peut-être y aller. Ok, Marcel, c'est bon? Okay, so we have some logistical problems, but it seems to me that they are solved. So we are going to start. We are 5 minutes late. So we'll resume this discussion and exchange on the governance of conjunctive use of underground water and surface water in agriculture. Today we have, well, this morning we have quite an important agenda since we'll have 8 posters and 8 papers to be presented. Then we'll have to, I think it's important to have a 30-minute break between 10:30 and 11 for a coffee break and for a possibility to exchange together. So it means that we'll start with for 1 hour and a half and we'll start with the poster presentation. In this poster presentation, each speaker has exactly 3 minutes. It's very important to respect this time slot. Olivier Petit here will be the timekeeper, and he'll be. He'll sit, here, and he'll show you when you have only 1 minute left. We'll start with the first poster. Closas Alvar. Is Closas Alvar here? Okay. So for 3 minutes exactly.
Time is running.
Is this working? Yeah. Good morning. I have the dubious honor to initiate the session in the morning, so I hope I can keep you awake at least for 3 minutes. Then it's not my turn anymore. I apologize. I have no slides, but I'll try to keep it short and simple and to the point. My poster, which everyone is happy to come by later and ask more questions, is about the limits to the implementation of regulation and to control and manage groundwater abstraction in the MENA region. This is part of a USAID-funded project that we've initiated, me and François Moll from Cairo in Egypt. And as we've seen before yesterday with the previous presentations by Marcel and my colleague François, groundwater over-abstraction is a vexing phenomenon, and control and regulation is clearly a challenge, be it by the state or be it by the communities and users. And what we've seen basically throughout the first 2 years of this project is that we've analyzed certain arrangements, be it by the state or be it by the communities in the region, and we've seen that there's basically it's not a clear cut between who does what, like whether the state does things or whether the community does things to regulate groundwater. We've found them all along a continuum. That is not easily divided. There's always a role for the community. There's always a role for the state, and we've clearly seen that in our studies. Access and ownership is obviously either private or public. You know, there's a lot of experience in the region, in the Middle East, North Africa region, on public management of irrigation schemes. Transferred wells that were previously owned publicly were transferred privately. And also there's a huge array of private initiatives such as small wells, corporate agribusinesses, owners within arrangements between users and conjunctive use. However, this puts us in a, as I said, in this governance continuum that is fluid, illustrates the arrangements to control and regulate, and in a way matches a little bit with Marcel's kind of concept introduced yesterday of negotiated disorder between those arrangements. However, there's limitations to regulation, be it by pertaining to the state only, such as poor data, weak monitoring, lack of resources. There's clearly a lack of defined administrative roles within agencies. These are all results from the project. Corruption of political elites using local leaders for gains, and obviously government subsidies driving over abstraction. Pertaining to the community, regulation limitations concern lack of awareness of users, which was mentioned yesterday. Users also, was mentioned yesterday, can opt out of state irrigation via exit strategies. And I believe Olivier would also talk about this, maybe. And power dynamics within the community itself. And also final pressure, external pressures to regulation. International donors can sometimes support projects that can destabilize traditional communities and traditional arrangements. And the naturally, slowly occurring nature of the resource, of groundwater, can challenge established rules because the results are not seen immediately. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Quite a difficult exercise to present several years of work within 3 minutes. So the next speaker will be Alhaga Doha about the Nile Delta.
I am Doha Al-Agha, working at the International Water Management Institute in Cairo office. My books are about the boom of groundwater use in the Nile Delta. It's about a survey that has been done recently about the expansion of the groundwater use in the central part of the Nile Delta. The work explored several parts of the phenomena. It's the reasons for the farmers' groundwater use, despite there's also surface water in the area. Can we go down? Central part of the Nile Delta. Maybe someone knows about that. This part of the Nile Delta is salt water intrusion problem, and this part is still have some transition zone and a good groundwater. Right.
Okay.
Zone and good groundwater.
Thank you.
So the use of groundwater in that particular area is critical. So we explored why farmers use the groundwater, what is the social arrangement and the economic dimensions, and the water quality in that area, also the legal situation of these wells. And we focused after to a specific area with one canal running in the central part of the Nile Delta with a specific boundary focus on a specific canal with a boundary to estimate the intensity of the groundwater use, the variability of well density, and special distribution in the variability also of salinity. And also we discussed the relationship between water supply and the groundwater use. There's a poster that has some details, and you are welcome to ask any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And now it's about China. It's Ardu. Well.
Okay, I will introduce myself. My name is Asia Arnouts.
Okay.
My poster is actually about work I did for my PhD, which I'm finalizing now, which is about my PhD is about the conjunctive use and management of surface water and groundwater in three inland basins in the northwest of China. I did a household survey and interviews in the area in 2013 and 2014. And my poster is only, of course, part of the results from my research and basically about the state of conjunctive use in the area and to what extent farmers' groundwater use is also determined by the surface water supply. I want to give a little bit some background about the idea of my poster, what I present on my poster. So in fact, my research took place in three inland river basins, which are all located in one area in northwest China. It's called the Hexi Corridor. And it can be considered as one hydrological unit with a water source on the Chilean mountains, like the Tibetan Plateau, and the rivers all ending in the Gobi Desert. And on the plains of these river basins, farmers, there's very intensive agriculture with water from the rivers and also from the aquifers, from the alluvial aquifers. But although the hydrogeology in these three river basins is very similar, the groundwater management is very different. And I also already spoke about one case in these three river basins yesterday where there's very strict groundwater regulation. But at the same time, the government in this very strict groundwater regulated area, the government also increased the surface water supply. So I came up with the question like whether these costly groundwater regulations maybe didn't need to happen if the farmers would also reduce their groundwater use only when the surface water supply increased. So to answer this question, I basically looked at the other two river basins and analyzed like the relation between the surface water supply and farmers' groundwater use. And based on the household data, I can see there's a very strong link, of course, between the surface water supply and how much groundwater farmers use. But when I put the data in a model, I actually found that farmers replace one surface water turn with 1.5 groundwater turn, which actually means they also use the groundwater to intensify their agriculture. So I think just improving surface water supply will not directly regulate the groundwater, but I do think it can be used in a way to relieve also excessive groundwater use in specific locations, and also to some extent to increase farmers' acceptance of groundwater regulations.
Okay, thank you very much. Now the next speaker is Arturo González from Mexico. Is he here? No, there is no Arturo González. So it will be Yüksel Asambasri from Turkey.
Good morning. My poster is related to the central region of Turkey, which takes the least precipitation. So there are a number of illegal wells in order to execute the agricultural activities in Turkey. The State Hydrographic General Directorate is responsible for the main institution responsible for the irrigation activities in Turkey. So in order not to penalize illegal wells, the government tried to direct the farmers and the government would like also try to increase the surface water resources by implementing transboundary projects. And interbasin projects. In the central part of the Turkey, the farmers grow maize and sugar, maize which necessitate much water, and the farmers also try to grow the sugar beets. So these crop types consumes much water, groundwater. So the government tried the farmers to grow the water-saving crops like wheats and other type of crops. So this type of regulations and encouragements direct the farmers to choose the, much more crop water-saving projects. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So we'll stay in Turkey with Gungor Yasen. Aysen, is he here? No, only one, okay. And then we'll move to Pakistan now with Basharat Mohammed. Well, no Pakistani. Okay. And so now we go to Taiwan now with Chang Chi Cheng. Is he here? No, he's not here. Well, so it's faster than I expected, you know.
You can give us three more minutes.
Okay, excellent. So we'll move directly to, we'll have more time for a discussion. You know, I think it's important to be very strict on the time for the paper presentation and have more time for discussion. So the first speaker will change quite a bit, you know, quite slightly. The presentation will start with Fayrap Aynur, who will present a paper on Turkey, as two Turkish people were not there, you know, and so I think it's quite natural to give the floor to another president from that country. So I remind you that you have 15 minutes for your presentation, and then we'll give 5 minutes for this for click question for clarification. If somebody did not understand something about your presentation, there will be 5 minutes for question requesting clarification. It's not a discussion. I remind you that the discussion will be at the very end of this meeting, just before around noon.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm from Turkey. My poster's title is Agricultural Groundwater Management in Turkey, you can see. My presentation outlines are agricultural groundwater use in Turkey in general aspect is presented here. Groundwater irrigation cooperatives, state groundwater irrigations, public institution irrigations, and individual farmer irrigations, and the last section is a consideration. Agricultural groundwater use in Turkey. Turkey, unfortunately, isn't a water-rich country. The available water per capita in Turkey is less than the world average. Approximately 73% of limited water resources of Turkey is allocated for agricultural purposes. Irrigated with groundwater comprises of approximately 23% of total irrigated agricultural area. In this context, agricultural groundwater is very critical and is very important issue for our country. Groundwater activity in Turkey have been executed by General Directorate of State Hydraulic Works that I work in this institution. And groundwater activities on behalf of state according to the law on groundwater, according to the law, groundwater is under the decree and possession of the state. So agricultural groundwater is under the control of state in the situation. Any research, allocation, utilization, protection, registration of groundwater are subject to the law. The law number is 160. Within the framework of the groundwater law, whenever and wherever each person intends to construct a water structure in order to provide groundwater, including drinking well, excavating galleries, tunnels, or pumping system, they should get license from DSI. Groundwater law puts in order on groundwater first to conduct surveys of groundwater and drill deep wells or have done drill, transfer or lease deep wells, protect and record groundwater, grant lease license for survey, use, and rehabilitation and modification of wells. Groundwater management is performed in four types in our country. These are groundwater irrigation cooperatives, DSI or state groundwater irrigations, public institution irrigations, and individual farmer irrigations. Groundwater activity concerning irrigation cooperatives are jointly carried out by General Directorate of State Hydraulic Works, shortly DSI, and other the other institution, Agricultural Development Sectional Directorate of Province Special Administration, SPA, shortly. There is an agreement between DSI and SPA. All activity are followed according this mentioned agreement. This agreement consists of responsibility of both of two organizations. Farmers, firstly, establish irrigation cooperatives. At first, cooperatives members comprises of only seven people, and then want DSA or SPA to construct irrigation schemes. In the content of this activity, responsibility of DSI are hydrogeologic survey is carried out. If groundwater quality and quantity is suitable, feasibility report is prepared. If it is optional report, project is started and groundwater wells are drilled by DSI and electrification systems are built and pumps are provided and mounted. Shortly, performing of hydrogeological survey, preparing of feasibility reports, drilling of wells, building of electrification system, and providing of pumps are under the responsibility of DSI. Irrigation system can be constructed by either of them, DSI and the mentioned institution, SPAI. All schemes, including wells, pumps, electrification systems, irrigation systems, are transferred transferred to the cooperatives, namely user organizations. All investment cost constructed by DSI is refunded in 50 years by users without any interest. First 3 years, called adaptation period. They do not pay, farmers do not pay during this period, adaptation period. It is paid in 12 years as equal shares, but without any interest. As of 2040, an area of 482 hectares has been irrigated by means of 11,700 deep wells by groundwater irrigation cooperatives. Presently, there are 1,400 irrigation cooperatives intensely in Konya, Isparta, Eskişehir, Kayseri, Edirne, Samsun, and İzmir province. I can say that in this region, spring and dripping irrigation is intensively applied. This type of groundwater irrigation is performed to supply groundwater into irrigation canal where surface water is insufficient. First option is surface water, but surface water is insufficient. In this condition, I have to irrigate with groundwater. Operation and maintenance services were by made DSI. This situation is valid for the DSI groundwater irrigation. As of 2040, 2,051 deep wells are used in 100,470 hectares of DSI groundwater irrigations. I mentioned in this irrigation facilities, irrigation systems, operation and maintenance are responsible for DSI, but in this situation, operation and maintenance services leads to financial problem. And the situation, irrigation performance is decreased. For overcome in the situation, from year to year, the responsibility of operation, maintenance, and management of these irrigation networks are being transferred to the irrigation organizations. In the need of public institution, mostly agricultural organizations, all equipment related to irrigation scheme are provided by DSI. DSI drills groundwater wells and provides irrigation scheme with equipments on the cost recovery base. This application is valid for public institution irrigations. Afterwards, they are transferred to public institution. The operation of this project is performed by related institutions. Generally, these related institutions, agricultural institutions. As of 2040, in 32 projects with 2,161 drilled wells, 84,080 hectare area have been irrigated by groundwater for public institutions. Individual farmer irrigations. As per related law, as I mentioned, this law, land owners are or farmers can irrigate their own fields from individually operated groundwater wells. To operate them, farmers have to get a user's license from DSI if the well depth is more than 10 meters. But in this extraordinary conditions, this depth is decreased to 5 meters. For extraordinary condition, I say, of coastal area, especially in coastal area, permission depth is 5 meters to avoid from seawater intrusion. There are three different license in this situation. Four license is exploration license, and the other license of utilization, and last one modification of license of modification. Each farmer who wants to consume groundwater for irrigation should get license from DSI according to the groundwater law. 3,430 billion cubic meters was allocated for individual groundwater irrigations. 972 users license have been granted for individual irrigations for 2040.
In 1 year?
Totally. By 2040. Okay. You can see the ratio of groundwater irrigation area which are irrigated from facility built by DSI in summary of the presentation. The ratio of groundwater irrigation for irrigation cooperative is 72%, and the ratio is 50% for DSI groundwater irrigations and 30% for public institutions, you know. Big proportion belong to irrigation cooperative. From year to year, operational rights of irrigation networks are being transferred to irrigation organization. There are several organizations responsible for development, management, and conservation of groundwater resources. DSI, as a water authority in our country, is the main organization responsible for the development, management, and conservation of groundwater resources. Foundation of irrigation cooperatives and education of the farmers, which is very important for us in our country, are performed by Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Affairs. Groundwater has been over-extracted, unfortunately. Therefore, the groundwater initiated some measures to control the use of groundwater. Some gauging systems have been necessary in order to measure the groundwater use. As per law, it has been imperative that gauging systems are to be installed in the boreholes. Mentioned, they say DSI groundwater gauging system regulation come into effect in 2011. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. So now we have 5 minutes for a question of clarification. Is there any persons who needs this kind of precision on this presentation? No? Yes. Please, could you... Okay.
Thank you. I am Dr. K.Y. Reddy from Hyderabad, India. It's a good presentation, very
Thank
informative.
You.
The issue is that the groundwater is also very important for us in India. Now, how this is really the farmers' participation, the cooperatives.
Yeah.
Because when we take canal water, you said this is pumped into canal where there is a deficit of surface water. Okay, you said this will be pumped into the canals wherever there is a deficit of surface water. How the farmers will pay for the water? Because in surface irrigation, it is very... very much subsidized. The farmers pay less amount in our country too. But when it comes to the groundwater, they have to invest a lot of money.
The farmers
have to invest a lot of money for the same purpose of water.
Yeah.
So we carry surface water from far off distances to the farmer fields. Okay, and they irrigate.
Yeah.
And some places when they pump on their own, they have to invest money on the pumping systems and drilling the wells. And then it will be very expensive for them. So you might be aware that a lot of farmers committing suicides in India because when they invest a lot of money on groundwater, So sometimes this is critical. I want to know that how in Turkey it happens, how much the farmers will pay for water, for the surface water, and in operating these systems. So when they are handed over to the farmers, then how they manage the systems over the years. Can you please tell us?
In our country, groundwater facility, there are electrical counter system for pricing water, and the amount of groundwater given for our well, and certain prices is very changeable from year to year. Farmer pay this fee, this electrification fee.
Is there a difference between the surface water price and the groundwater price? That's the question, I think.
Yes, operation system is different, groundwater facility and surface water facility. In our country, surface irrigations are transferred water users organizations. Operation, maintenance, and the other responsibilities belong to QAS, water user organizations, and payment is responsible for users organizations, because the services is belong to water users organizations. The water users irrigations determine own price. State not responsible. Yes, transferred all of the services, payment, or operation, maintenance, because water user organizations have to make operation, maintenance, and you collect fee for these services, water users organizations. Irrigation cooperatives in the main organizations for groundwater, in the stations valid, but water payment is belong to is irrigation cooperative. State isn't collect payment. And determining for payment is responsible for irrigation cooperative. Free.
Okay.
Changeable.
So, well, there are several questions. You can ask your question, but be very, very, very short.
Good morning. I understood from your presentation that all Hassan Lamrani from Morocco.
Okay.
I understood from your presentation that all groundwater abstractions are licensed. Is it true?
Yeah.
And in this case, how do you monitor the volume extracted from groundwater?
Volume.
Yeah.
By using electrical counter by using. Which organizations, cooperatives, and water resource organizations is responsible for determined the volume of water with by means of electrical counter. Irrigation cooperatives is responsible.
Okay. Another question, short question, and you should introduce yourself, you know, before speaking, just for recording purposes.
Thanks. I'm Carlos Sanchez from Spain. I'd like to know if after transferring the wells to farmers, the DSI is capable to recover or to close, to recover the management or to close the wells if groundwater is overexploited.
I can understand you.
Yes, well, after transferring the wells,
yeah.
Maybe the farmers overexplode the aquifer and they put in risk the sustainability of the aquifer. Then in that case, the DSI can recover the management of the well, mm-hmm. can paralyze the exploration?
Yes, yes, we can. But we can, but we have to get investment manage investment money or recovery money. We have to pay. Collect to pay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe just another one, and it will be, and we'll pass to another presentation.
Hasan Yüksel from Turkey. It is not a question. It is a clarification of the groundwater management in Turkey. In Turkey, we have already developed groundwater irrigations. Now we would like to reduce the groundwater area by developing the surface water irrigation systems. So we don't want to see the, any drilling machines in Turkey. We send all the state drilling machines to the some least developed countries in Africa in order to drill and supply the drinking water for yeah. there. So in Turkey, we have developed our capacity. The groundwater irrigation has been developed, and we sometimes use the excess water during the drought years. Also, therefore, we would like to give priority surface irrigations in Turkey. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we'll stop here. This point could be can be. Rediscussed during the general discussion at the end of the session. And now we'll move to a presentation by Ivan Alchenko from IMI. And if I understand correctly, it's a general presentation of the use of groundwater in Africa.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm Ivan Alchenko. I'm based in IMI, Southern Africa, and I'm in Segamen IMI from the French Ministry of Agriculture. So my talk will be a general talk about the potential of irrigation from renewable groundwater in Africa. So my presentation will be based on some a bit of context in Africa, and then I will talk about the mapping of sustainable groundwater irrigation potential, something I call GWIP, and that's a paper I've been published and you can download it for free. And I'm talking after about the mapping of the groundwater development potential, and it's an ongoing project, and I call that the GWDP. So basically, the difference between the two and three part is the mapping of the GWIP is a quantitative approach of the potential, and the GWDP is a qualitative approach of the potential. And finally, I will give some conclusion about it. So just a little bit of context. So there is a need to increase crop production in Africa to meet future food demand. And here I give you some data in Africa. So the population is projected to reach about 1.6 billion by 2013, which is about half a billion people more than by now. Undernourished population increased by 30 million over the last 20 years. The crops themselves represent 89% of the diet in sub-Sahara Africa, and the human food community is to increase by 15% in the next 40 years. So basically, there is a need to increase the crop production. So the crop production growth in sub-Saharan Africa is mainly due to extension of cultivated area and cropping intensity. And we can notice that compared to Asia, the crop yield improvement is really low in Africa. So basically, irrigation can play a significant role in increasing crop yield, but development of area equipped for irrigation is slow in Africa. And on this graph here, you can see the expansion of the irrigated area in Asia and here in Africa. So you can see that there is a big difference between the both continents. So now, if we're talking about groundwater and irrigation with groundwater, groundwater is an underutilized water source for irrigation in Africa. Only 1% of the cultivated land is equipped for irrigation. But the thing is, there is recent study saying that there is a huge storage in Africa. That's a study from McDonald. But obviously, not all is available for abstraction and evenly distributed. And I put this graph here just to show as well the difference you have between Asia and Africa. So in green, you have the cultivated land. In light blue, you have the total land equipped for irrigation. And in dark blue, the one equipped for irrigation but with groundwater. So you can see the big difference between the two countries. And there is some advantages to use groundwater for irrigation. First of all, groundwater provides an important buffer to climate change and variability. It's relatively affordable, safe, and reliable, especially in rural Africa. And another fact is yields in groundwater irrigated area are typically much more higher than in surface water scheme, and that's only because the control of the water is better. So there is basically two questions to reply to understand the potential for the groundwater irrigation in Africa. Is where and how much of an area can renewable groundwater potentially irrigate over Africa? And that's a quantitative approach. And where should groundwater irrigation be developed in Africa? And that's a qualitative approach. So about the quantitative approach, the calculation have been done based on the water balance done over a 41-year period, and has been done through GIS at the resolution of 50K by 50K cells. So basically, the simple equation is you just get the groundwater available, and you divide by the irrigation water demand. And this calculation has been done annually over the 41 year. So in this calculation, the groundwater available has been decided to just take one value to just take in consideration the buffer effect of the groundwater. So to calculate this groundwater available, we took the groundwater recharge minus the human groundwater demand minus the environment groundwater requirement. So basically, we did the calculation annually. So we did the calculation annually for the groundwater recharge. But for these two parameters, we just took one value for, and we took, because the only data we have was the density of population. And so we did decide to apply the same value for each year, and that's the value for the year 2000. For the irrigation water demand, we calculated it using the crop water demand minus the green water. So the green water is the water that the crop can receive from the rain directly or indirectly from the soil moisture. We multiply by the area of the crop and we divide by the irrigation efficiency. And this calculation has been done monthly, and then we sum it to have an annual value to apply to this equation. For doing this calculation, we add some assumption. And so the first one is that the groundwater is the only source for irrigation. There is no conjunctivity with surface water. The second one is the groundwater is usable and accessible, so we don't have any issue with the economic, socioeconomic constraints, quality of the water, or yield of the wells. And the groundwater is locally available. So here's a bit more about the methodology. So the data from the hydrological data have been took from a model developed by the Ustral University, and so that's a bucket leaking model. So we took the reference evapotranspiration to calculate the crop water demand. We extract as well the transpiration from soil 1 and 2 to calculate the green water. And so we decided to do that because to be really conservative in the approach and not overestimate what the water that the crop can get from the rain. And we obviously took the recharge from this model. For the other groundwater use, we took the human activities, which is domestic, like stop and industrial. And what I say, we took density of population and livestock from the year 2000. For the environment requirement, because it was really difficult to have some value about it, we just decided to go for three different scenarios. So we decided to have scenario one is 70% of the recharge go to the environment, 50% of the recharge go to the environment, and scenario three is 30% of the recharge go to the environment. And finally, to have the crop data, we needed some crop distribution. We needed the crop water demand based on crop coefficient and reference evapotranspiration over the 41 years. We needed the irrigation efficiency, that's from FIO data and based on the crop zone. There is 23 in Africa. And so basically we built a calendar, a monthly calendar for the crop water demand. And I'm not really developing on that because that will take too much time. So basically here are some results about it. So here you have the average net irrigation water demand. So that's in quantity, and here is this in millimeter per year. So basically I put in here the distribution, the crop distribution through Africa, and you have the rainfall. So you can see that the pattern are following both. So there is less water demand in area, there is more rain. And here you can see that there is a lot of water demand because of the arid condition you can have in Africa. So basically now when you talk about the irrigation potential from renewable groundwater, so here I put the map of the proportion of cropland irrigable with groundwater. And that's the scenario one, so 30% go to the environment. 70% go to the environment, 50% go to the environment, and 30% of the recharge go to the environment. So what you can see here is that there is some trend, that there is a kind of big potential in this zone, which is between Kenya and Tanzania through Angola. You have a big potential as well here, and you have a huge potential also in Central Africa. And so what you can see, if you take the worst case, we can still have more than 20, a factor of 20 to increase of the groundwater irrigation potential, because we can go from 2 million hectare to 40 million hectare. Here I just did a comparison between the actual irrigation with groundwater, that's from Seibert, and I just compare with my data. So basically that indicates that in a green area, we can irrigate more than the actual irrigation, and in the red area, which is mainly here, it means that you cannot irrigate, obviously, what they already irrigate with the renewable groundwater. So now, if I go to the qualitative approach, we took different parameters to show the constraint or what the parameter can promote the groundwater irrigation development. And we decided to have five parameters. So the distance to surface water, the distance to market, the soil suitability for agriculture, the drilling cost, which is basically the depth of the groundwater, and the distance to the electricity, because it's easier and cheaper actually for the farmer to use electricity than diesel for running the pump. So we built some database at the 500 meter cell resolution, and we rank this parameter into five classes: very poor, poor, moderate, good, and very good for groundwater development. And we combine them through equal weight method. So here I just give you the database map. So these two maps are based on a country assessment, which means that we consider that for the surface water, there is no exchange between country, and that's the same from the market. For the surface water, it's just based on the watershed of the river and the lake and the reservoir in Africa. So obviously, when you like the blue, is very really high potential because you are far from any surface water. So for the distance to market, is based on the road network in Africa and on towns. And that's the same. More you are far from a town on the oral road, and less you have potential because there is basically no market to sell your products. So here is about the soil suitability and the drilling costs, and it's a stress translation of already existing database. So the soil suitability is from the GAEZ, database, and I invite you to go to the website because it's really interesting, the GAEZ. And the second one, the drilling cost, is based on the depth of groundwater developed by McDonald's, by the BGS. And finally, the last one is access to electricity. And so that's based from the Earth at Night satellite picture from NASA. And so that's just a translation of this satellite picture. And so you can see that it's a kind of good representation, actually, of the rural electrification in Africa, which is quite poor. And I decided to, when I rank it, to not go to the poor or very poor potential, because anyway you can still use diesel or other energy source than electricity. That's why it's green, most of it. But when it's green, it basically means that there is no electricity. So now I put the two maps. So this one is the combination on the FAF parameter. So you can see there is a kind of big potential in this area, also in the South Africa, Mozambique, and Botswana. And is linked mainly because of the market, because there is huge market here. And that's the previous map about the quantitative approach. So what you can see is there is some correlation here in this part from this stripe in Tanzania and Kenya through Angola. You also have a big potential here, but you also have some potential in the Sahel area, which is quite important because of the poverty alienation potential of this groundwater. What you can also see is if you look at the Ethiopia, there is a distribution, the potential is not evenly distributed in the country, and that's also interesting to know. There is not potential everywhere in the country. So now, just for a conclusion, so a continental scale distributed map of groundwater irrigation potential will be produced for the first time on the continental scale, and the map on the groundwater development potential is in progress for the first time as well. So if you want to reply to Google, can we locate and quantify the groundwater irrigation development potential in Africa? Yes, and those maps show potential variability across Africa and even within the countries. Potential can be significantly can be particularly significant in some area, and what I'll say about is in west of Ethiopia, in the Sofala region in Mozambique, southwest of Western Africa, and the strip between Tanzania, Kenya to Angola. There is significant potential in Central Africa, but it might not be largely irrelevant because there is quite a lot of rainfall there. The potential is particularly significant and relevant in semi-arid Sahel and East Africa corridor, especially for small-scale and small-order irrigation with huge poverty alienation potential. Climate change might affect the groundwater recharge and increase the crop water demand, and that's something we didn't take in consideration in the calculation. And to finish, actual potential will be greatly influenced by irrigation efficiency and crop choices. So obviously, if you have crop, you have less water demand, you can increase the potential. And the same for irrigation efficiency. We decided to take efficiency from surface water irrigation, and we know that with groundwater, usually the efficiency is better. And that's all for me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ivan. Question, something which is not clear for somebody about this presentation of the potential for groundwater irrigation in Africa. There are no question. If there is no question, we'll move. Obviously, you know, this paper was a little different from the other, since this one was not dealing with existing groundwater abstraction, but dealing with the potential for increasing groundwater. So maybe that's the reason why it's, you have no question, and it's true that it was very clear, too. So let's go to the another one. Oh, a question over there. Just... two questions. Another one here.
Yeah, thank you, Thierry Facon from FAO. So, have you estimated? Are you estimating how much this development potential can contribute in terms of additional food production or meeting food demand or socioeconomic goals?
Yes, it's planned actually. The next step from here is just calculating what the food production can be with this potential.
Okay, another one.
Thank you, Samson Agoja from Ghana. It's quite obvious by the maps you've shown that the potentials are mostly in the major water basins, the major river basins, other than other places. In that context, is it better to consider irrigation water in the context of both surface and groundwater, rather than only groundwater, please?
So the calculation have been based to show the real potential of groundwater, but obviously if you add the potential with the surface water, you have a bigger potential for the area you can irrigate, and you increase also the resilience of the farmer against the climate variability you can have. So I think actually that if you use surface and groundwater is probably the best approach you can have. But not everyone can do that, because you need also to be quite close to surface water reservoir or river, which is not the case everywhere in Africa. So,
okay. Maybe we'll move to the to another presentation by Imi. This time it's about the use of solar energy, and the paper will be presented by Bradley Franklin.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I'm Brad Franklin. I'm with EME New Delhi office. And so today I'd like to talk about solar irrigation pumps, especially in the context of India, which is a very different kind of groundwater use context from what Yvonne was just talking about, given that India, correct me if I'm wrong, if anybody knows differently, but I'm pretty sure India's uses more groundwater than any country in the world, and I think it's by a wide margin. The Modi administration has kind of been pushing renewable energy generally, and they recently have some agreement with the German government where €1 billion were given to develop solar projects. The government is promoting solar generally, but a big part of it, or a significant portion of it, is devoted to solar irrigation pumps, with an announced goal of 26 million solar irrigation pumps, which is probably an aspirational kind of target rather than a realistic goal, I imagine, in the near future. So just to talk about the general context of groundwater use in India, the map on the lower left shows basically level of groundwater use in different blocks across India. And so red is bad, because that means you're overexploiting the amount of groundwater, And so you can see in the northwest India, it's very highly overexploited. Also in peninsular India, there's a lot of red. But then in the eastern states, and on the right side, you see kind of a blow up of some states that I'm looking at. The orange states in that blow up, Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, West Bengal, there's a real lack of electricity, and so that's really limited to the groundwater pumping. So we kind of have two stories in India about groundwater use, and it's really very largely driven by access to affordable energy. So the question is, when you introduce solar pumps into this context, how does that change things? So for this study, what I'm talking about today, I've applied this model to Punjab state. So Punjab state is very highly productive. It's nearly 100% irrigated, and two seasons a year irrigated. And but groundwater is being used very, very unsustainably. So it's about 70% more groundwater withdrawn each year than can be replenished. And so then one issue is that, well, a big issue here is that there's a lot of subsidies in Indian agriculture, and in Punjab state, the farmers have access to free electricity up to some number of hours a day, and so that tends to promote overuse of groundwater. Okay, so then thinking about the economics of groundwater management and the where I'm coming from, generally economists have thought about what are the gains to managing groundwater effectively if you can monitor things, and you know there's all the governance issues that we've all been talking about, but if you could do everything perfectly, what are the gains from that? But generally, this literature assumes that at least that farmers are paying for the electricity or the energy that they use to pump the groundwater. However, in India and many areas of India, that's not the case. I suspect in other areas of the developing world, that's also not the case. So there's effectively no incentive for farmers to conserve if you don't pay for the energy that you're using. Okay. Now, the issue with solar pumps is that the same thing happens if you already have a solar pump in place, then as much electricity as you can generate with your system, that you can use that freely, okay? So there's no incentive to conserve. So this could potentially be a problem worldwide as solar pumps become much more affordable. The landscape is changing very fast, and some engineering studies have already shown that theoretically solar is already more advantageous than using, for instance, electricity. Okay. So the question is, if people are not paying for the for pumping, for the energy used for pumping groundwater, how do you manage groundwater in such a, how do you give farmers an incentive in such an environment? And one answer is that, okay, if everyone has solar pumps, then we'll buy back the excess electricity, give them an incentive so that they're not just using all the electricity to pump. Okay, so this brings up a few research questions, which I don't think have really been explored very fully yet. And so first question is, what's the correct buyback price? If you're buying electricity from the farmer, what should that? Well, how much should you pay them? Okay, and is that an affordable price that you're paying? Okay, and how do you structure the buyback scheme generally? What are the rules? How do you implement it? And then there are technical issues involved. How do you deal with those? I'm not going to talk about those, but suffice to say that there are quite a few challenges. Okay, so then the correct price, you know, depends on how much is the water worth to a farmer. Okay, so and how much, you know, how much is the water worth to a farmer, and how much electricity do they need to pump that water? So that gives you the value of electricity to the farmer, okay? So you need to give them some incentive, so you need to pay them. So if they use X amount of water and you don't want them to pump any further, then you need to say, okay, how much is a little bit more water worth to a farmer? We need to pay them something so that they won't use that electricity to pump, okay? But then you have a question of arbitrage. If, for instance, I can get electricity from either my farm or a neighboring farm, which is at a given price, but then the utility is buying back electricity at a higher price, well, I can scam the system, I can cheat the system, okay? So theoretically, you want a price which is between the value to the farmer and whatever the rate is that farmers are paying. However, I just told you that in Punjab state and many places, farmers pay nothing, so you can't have a price less than zero, so that's a problem, right? So for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to assume that it is possible technically to separate farmers with solar pumps from other farmers so that you can make sure that they're not cheating the system. And in fact, they've proposed this in some trials in India. They've proposed something like at the village or block level that all farmers agree to, you know, get solar pumps, but then they cannot get electricity from the grid. They have a one-way connection to sell back to the grid. Okay, so if it's technically possible to do that, then the question is what's affordable to the utility? And in the case of Punjab state, the subsidy is worth something like 3 to 4 rupees per kilowatt hour. So I'm going to assume that 4 rupees per kilowatt hour is kind of a threshold level that it's not financially sustainable to pay them more than that. Okay, so then the question is, how do you know what the value to the farmer is? And there's different ways to address that, but in my case, I've used an mathematical optimization model, which I won't really talk about the details of, but the few things to know about it are that it takes into consideration agronomic factors, economic factors as well, including the price of inputs and the price of crops. So, and also I tried to account for water, all water availability as best as I possibly can. So, given my model, what do I do then is I generate what's called a demand curve. It just gives you some indication of the value of water so the marginal value of water is what it actually tells you. So, given I have X amount of water, if I have a little bit more water, how much would I be willing to pay for that? Okay, so there's two main seasons in Punjab state, Kharif and Rabi seasons. So Kharif is summer, where there's a lot of water available, but there's a very high crop water requirements. So there's still the majority of the groundwater pumping occurs during that season. However, in the Rabi season, there's almost no rain, but there's a lot of irrigation that occurs. So that's very much dependent on whatever irrigation supplies are available. So this plot just shows you that for the Rabi season, basically because there's no rainfall, irrigation water is really valuable to farmers. So you see that's a high, and it descends very steeply because there's much less water used in the Rabi season than Kharif season. Okay. So now, given that we have some estimate of value of water to farmers, then knowing the technical relationship of the amount of electricity required to pump water and the groundwater level, we can come up with the value of electricity to farmers. Okay, so this is the analogous plot from what we just saw with, so this is the marginal value of electricity to farmers. Okay, so then, but to be more concrete, we'll talk about two scenarios very briefly. So in the baseline scenario, I say, okay, what is the value of water given the observed levels of pumping in the baseline year, okay? And then the second scenario is, what if we had constrained farmers to only use a sustainable amount of water, okay, which I call the CGWB target, so which is Central Groundwater Board of India, that they estimate this. So for the baseline, it's... it's about 2 rupees per kilowatt hour is what I estimate over the whole Punjab state, okay, on average for the whole year. But then if you said, okay, we want to hit these sustainability targets, how much do we have to pay farmers to conserve? Then it's about 5 rupees per kilowatt hour. So given the threshold value of 4 rupees per kilowatt hour, this would seem to indicate that it's too expensive to pay farmers not to... to decrease pumping to the extent that we'd actually be using a sustainable amount of groundwater. However, it also indicates that at least if solar pumps were widely adopted, at least you could keep the situation from getting worse. It would be affordable to stop them from further over-pumping. However, and probably running out of time here, but a big thing is that these average values really obscure a lot of the heterogeneity over space and time. And basically, if you look at my paper, what I'm arguing for is you need some kind of a targeted policy to be effective and cost efficient in order to understand how to effectively give farmers incentives. So what we see is there's a wide range of values for farmers under the two scenarios by season. Okay, this is at the district level. And I don't know if the red shows up very well here, but the point is for these red values, these are all below the threshold value of 4 rupees per kilowatt hour, which indicates that, yes, you could effectively give farmers incentives to not overpump. But what you see is that for the Kharif season, yes, we could really keep overpumping from occurring. in the Rabi season, when water is more valuable, it's very difficult to give them incentives that would be affordable, and especially for the CGWB sustainability targets is way too expensive. And then one caveat, though, I'd like to add is that if you had a targeted policy where you gave people incentives to not overpump in the Kharif season, they'd probably sell you electricity, but then groundwater tables will not drop as fast, and then that means that for the same amount of electricity in the Rabi season, they could pump more groundwater because the table level's higher. So that could undermine the program. And so briefly to conclude, clearly the value of electricity to farmers is based on economic and technical factors. With solar pumps, the marginal cost of pumping is zero, so you need to give farmers some kind of incentive to keep them from overpumping. And you have to keep in mind that depending on what the true value of water to farmers is, there may be no feasible price that you can use to give them the proper incentives. So in the case of Punjab State, what I found so far indicates that you could use this kind of a scheme to prevent further over-exploitation of the aquifer, but it may be difficult to actually hit those sustainability targets, which is not surprising given that it's really heavily dependent on groundwater in Punjab State. And one last caveat to this research is that this whole approach that I've used is assuming profit-maximizing behavior by farmers, but then in many parts of the developing world, that's probably not a good assumption. If you have half a hectare of land and you grow rice and your family depends on that, then you're probably not willing to sell. If you have a solar pump, if you're lucky enough to have one, you probably would not be willing to sell it for any price because you need the crop itself. Okay, so that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And some question or is it all clear? Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Karen from IMI. Brad, you mentioned that for this to work, the farmers will have to give up their electricity connection to the grid, and that means that they would only have access to the solar power. So I'm just wondering if the farmers are willing to do that, because that means that they won't be able to pump when there's no sunshine, basically, and that would put them in a very vulnerable situation.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, this now in India, at least, this is kind of really at the trial basis. So us people like Tushar Shah, Imi, and other people across India are doing small trials. And so it's kind of a very controlled environment. So you can stipulate these kind of things when you do a trial. But then when it comes to reality, I mean, what's enforceable? What will farmers actually go along with? I don't know. Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's so many things that need to be sorted out to make this kind of a scheme viable. So I don't know. Thank you.
Alvar Closes from IMI. Thank you, Brad. But has it been observed already that there's further decrease of groundwater due to solar pump installation?
No.
And second question, has there actually been also observed that users with solar pumps might be selling excessive groundwater pump to other users, because we know that in some areas of India, and I don't know if it corresponds to the areas where the solar pumps have been installed, mm-hmm. there are informal, you know, groundwater exchange and services like from bigger users who have pumps selling groundwater to users who don't.
Right. Yeah. So the solar pump, in India, really, it's too early. There's very few. Really, it's right now, it's really only feasible with very high government subsidies. But, of course, the landscape is changing very fast. And, of course, if you think about other parts of the world where farmers have much better access to credit, much wealthier, you think about the developed countries, then you can easily manage, like, wow, this could happen really quickly, and then what are the effects going to be? But so I don't know. I don't think there's any data to answer these questions because I don't think it's been rolled out widely enough yet.
Okay. Last short question.
Thank you. I'm Professor Michel Guy from INAT Tunisia. And I want to ask a question on the energy that is collected from solar. Is it enough to use it for pumping? And is there any competition between normal electrical energy and solar energy.
Competition in what sense?
Which means that it is not enough.
Uh-huh.
Energy collected, it is not enough to use it pumping.
Okay. Right, yeah. So, I mean, it's really just a technical question. I mean, depending on the depth of the groundwater and your pump efficiency and this stuff, then it really, and it depends on how much solar radiation you receive at the location that you're at. So, but in theory, you could just keep adding solar panel arrays until you can generate enough electricity to pump no matter what the depth is. And so there's an engineering study by Kelly et al., I think 2013, where they did a study of, like, across the world, five different locations, and they found, in every case, they found that solar is feasible, economically feasible, and more advantageous than even electricity at current levels. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Bradley. Now we'll move to a last presentation before the coffee break. It will be by Kevin Delvecchio. It's about Morocco again.
Good morning. To present myself, I am a PhD candidate in political sciences, and I actually work in Morocco on, implementation of aquifer contract. The plan of my presentation, I will introduce the subject and ask a question if that the public issue of over-exploitation could be seen as a quiet public issue. We'll see in the literature what does it mean in particular. And then show a few examples of what I call local redefinition or reappropriation of the issue. And then other more rapid conclusion on scientific controversies about this redefinition and competition between different sectors. So, in Morocco, the 1905 Water Act import an importation of the integrated water resource management model in the country, with the creation of the Water Basin Agency to manage the resource. And for the specific case of groundwater management, promotes the aquifer contracts that are the actual international tool that is privileged for aquifer management. So, in my research, I'm interested in seeing all these tools, that are soft tools, because there is no really clear model or clear method defined to tell us what is an aquifer contract and what we have to do in an aquifer contract. So I want to analyze the local reappropriation of these two, making the hypothesis that the within the implementation of these tools, we can see processes of redefinition of the issue itself. So, in political sciences, there is a tradition of public issue constriction studies that is a constructivist approach that make the hypothesis that an issue does not exist by itself, but it has to be objectified to become a public issue. That is to say, we have to collect data and to construct knowledge on the problem to make the problem visible and readable by the different actors. That is to say, what we are actually doing when we are speaking of an aquifer, with percentage of decrease or evaluation of the over exploitation, and this public issue is the object of it becomes sometimes the object of public policy by the government and the administration. And the public issue construction studies really focus and often focus on the legislative part of that. That is to say, when we begin to speak of an issue, and then to make a law and to have solution and to that has to be implemented, but in reality, the implementation is really the kingpin of the entire process, and I think that the process of definition in the and particularly in the case of aquifer management in Morocco continues within the implementation process. So I tried to focus on that's a very general outlook on for aquifer in Morocco or within the administration has signed aquifer contract like in the Sousse region or is beginning the process toward the signature of a contract. Why can we speak about a quiet issue? I took the classification of Philippe Garreau that classified the processes of construction of public issue in two parts. The first part is when the mediatization is important, and it details the participation, political firm, mediatization models. And the other part is the when the issue is a more quiet issue, silent, more silent. And it is in two parts, the anticipation model and the corporatist one. In the anticipation model, the administration has the leading role, that is to say, it encourages the solution for to solve the issue without an important mediatization or participation through, for example, mediatize the social demand, for example. For example, when I speak of redefinition, of local redefinition, we have to first look at a national definition and a national vision. That can be that one from the ministry that classify the different aquifer of Morocco within two in function of two parameters that are the overexploitation of the aquifer itself and if the aquifer is situated within deficitary basin or an excedentary one. So that's the first definition of the issue that permit to define priorities. But as I said, we are more interested in the implementation. What will become this overexploitation issue within the implementation? And if we see what are currently the discussion and the focus of the administration within the different areas of studies, the definition is not the issue is not defined by the same manner. In the size, the problem seems to be seen as a lack of resources, a lack of equipment. So local administration are projected to create a new irrigated perimeter with a transfer of surface resource from the same water basin So that's a solution that is made possible by its situation within an excedentary basin. In the Tadla, where the basin is excedentary but a little bit less than the first one, the focus, local administration put the focus on the lack of coordination with local authorities to enforce control. And maybe we can explain this attention on the coordination with the local authority by a historical presence of the site more accurate through an important irrigation office in the region that is one of the most ancient in Morocco. And the Sousse case that I know the least, as to say, but it seems to be an important case study as it is a reference for a lot of actors in Morocco, and as it is the only aquifer contract that has been signed. We have the over-exploitation definition seems to be more oriented through technological possibilities as the development of really high technological equipment for irrigation. And that is permitted by a context where by a context of export-oriented agriculture, where the water prices may be high, or as to say, the local administration consider that water prices could be high and could be supported by agriculture. And the last one on the Bershid aquifer. Where there is no really surface water available in the region, in the nearest region, so the solution is more oriented by throughout the need for organization of agriculture of farmers. Maybe the solution is proposed by some local administration actors is the creation of association of irrigants to better coordination within a context of a limited resource that could be surface water supply, for example. So, as we say, the issue redefinitions within the territory are strongly connected to the solution. That is to say, it really depends of the context, not only the natural physical context of the aquifer, of the repartition of water, surface water, groundwater, but also political, historical. Context, and this process. I also speak of redefinition, of local redefinition of the issue, because when actors are local actors mobilize themselves to around the project of a new contract. They reopen, as to say, the scientific controversies. They not only take the data, the value, the measures given by the administration, but really engage in a discussion and in somewhat important debates to define over-exploitation, what we mean by over-exploitation. I tried to make two definitions that could be a drastic decrease of a groundwater table, but also only the exploitation of the non-renewable part of the resource. And then the focus can be made on the definition by only, for example, the percentage of irrigation of irrigated surfaces, to highlight, for example, in Bershit that the irrigation is not majority, but that's some lack of arguments to change the definition of the issue from a water issue to a more irrigation organization one. And then there is also the issue of communication of the aquifer information as some water basin agency sometimes to show a more accurate decrease of the groundwater table level could only give some data from a particular region and for some particular years. And finally, as to conclude, we see that within this local redefinition of the issue, there is also conciliation and debate between different policy objectives, as we, for example, talk yesterday between, for example, the water preservation, of the preservation of a social economic development, or somewhat. And another point that I won't have time to detail, but that is in the article, is the question of whether it is more efficient to have a quiet silences agreement. That seems to be the case in the Tadla region, where drinking water producer and industrial user of water are in the way to abandon the use of groundwater, rivers, and so that is to say, and there is no aquifer contract. But for compared to region, for example, in the Seis region, where the aquifer contract precede some sort of agreement like this between the sectors, so it could be seen as more like an imposition for some actor, for example, drinking water producers. I think the time is over, so I will answer your question if you have some.
So, any question before the coffee break? This is a high incentive to limit the number of questions. No question at present? Okay. So maybe we'll have a coffee break, and you'll have to come back to this room by 11, okay?